Irak is een puinhoop. Iran gaat nucleair. Israël is gedemoraliseerd en de Verenigde Staten zijn tot op het bot verdeeld. Tegenlicht zoomt in op het Midden-Oosten, 6 weken lang. Op de plaats des oordeels.
Israël lives.
Waar de nervositeit hand over hand toeneemt.
Israël lives.
Zijn we op weg naar een doemscenario? Deze week portret van een taboe. Het doen en laten van de machtige Israël-lobby in de Verenigde Staten. Twee gerenommeerde conservatieve Amerikaanse politicologen, Stephen Walt en John Mearsheimer, schreven in 2006 een artikel over de invloed van de Israël-lobby op de Amerikaanse buitenlandse politiek.
Ja, so you can see it came out March 23, 2006. And then, the title. I believe that the Harvard version has been downloaded over 350,000 times. Well, the United States supports Israel in a variety of ways. We give them all sorts of military and economic support, roughly $3 billion a year. Israel, despite the fact it is a relatively rich country, receives more foreign aid than any other country in the world. We veto resolutions in the United Nations all the time that are critical of Israel.
Ceux qui sont contre, 14 voix pour, une voix contre. Le projet de résolution n'est pas adopté par suite du vote négatif d'un membre permanent du Conseil.
Those against.
Ceux qui sont contre.
And the United States is actually talking about using military force against Iran. Now the question is, why is the United States so deeply concerned about Iran acquiring nuclear weapons? The reason it is that big a deal at this point in time is because of pressure from the lobby. Thank you. The article basically says that inside the United States there is a powerful interest group that is deeply committed to shaping American foreign policy in ways that work to the benefit of Israel. And second, the article argues that the policies that the United States ends up pursuing in the Middle East because of the lobby's force in the decision-making process are not in the American national interest.
Troops out now! Stop the war! Troops out now! Stop the war!
A free, prosperous, and secure Israel is in this nation's national interests.
In deze tijden van grote politieke onzekerheid in de Verenigde Staten en de naderende nederlaag in het Irak-moeras heeft dit artikel veel stof doen opwaaien. En zijn democraat en republikein, Amerikaan en Israëli, Jood en Christen, isolationist en interventionist over elkaar heen gevallen.
The scholarship is appalling in this piece.
Richard Perle was tot 2004 adviseur van de regering Bush op defensiegebied. Daarnaast adviseerde hij de voormalige Israëlische minister-president Benjamin Netanyahu.
The notion that that some people sitting in Jerusalem are pulling the strings on institutions that are somehow divorced from a sense of what is in the American interest and working instead for Israel, there's just no evidence to support that. I'm really surprised that they didn't seek to protect their reputations by doing really watertight, rigorous research that they could defend. And in fact, they've been demolished. Alan Dershowitz is, I mean, there's nothing left after.
So why did they go on
I don't know why they did this. I don't know.
Some of the things they say in that piece really made me wince, because Mearsheimer and Walt both are better academics than that report reflects.
Lawrence Wilkerson meldde zich vrijwillig aan om in Vietnam te gaan vechten. Zijn vader was piloot in de Tweede Wereldoorlog en zijn zoon dient nu in de luchtmacht. Wilkerson was van 2000 tot 2005 stafchef van Colin Powell.
But it does shed some light on a number of aspects, the most important of which is that we don't debate this issue in America. You know, you can't talk about this in America. That's the most important thing they did. The second thing they did was call into question, post-Cold War, the strategic value of Israel to America.
10 years ago, you couldn't even talk about the Israel lobby. Today we can, we do. It's explosive, it's controversial, but we do.
Tony Judd werd net na de Tweede Wereldoorlog geboren in Engeland als kind van Europese Joden. In de jaren 60 werkte hij in een kibbutz en voor het Israëlische leger. Hij vindt dat de geloofwaardigheid van de Israëlische staat steeds verder afneemt.
I wrote an article for the New York Times at the time of the Mearsheimer Walt essay came out, in which an op-ed. And they asked me for this, and I said, you should have written about the Mearsheimer Walt. They had not said anything. And they agreed, which was already a change, but they insisted that somewhere in the article I identify myself as a Jew, because this would give them protection. Controversial article about the Israel lobby. Yes, but he's Jewish, it's okay. That's where we are.
It's not fun to be called an anti-Semite. It's not fun to be told that your scholarship is shoddy. And it's not fun to be pounded day after day and to see very few people standing up in your defense. But again, we knew that was coming. We knew that was the price of writing the article.
They're right, but they're wrong. Now, they're right from a strictly geopolitical, geostrategic point of view. That is to say, what I spent my life studying. Israel no longer provides the United States a strategic value like it did during the Cold War. Not only that, Israel is a strategic burden on the United States. That's a big difference from Cold War days. At the same time, the fuller, more comprehensive strategist in me says that doesn't matter, because the connections between America and Israel are so great and so strong that geostrategy, political strategy, whatever you want, grand strategy, is of no consequence here. You actually take that psychological component up to the level of grand strategy, and you say, America can't get out of this even if it wanted to. So, Mr. Walt, Mr. Mearsheimer, you may be technically right, but you are pragmatically wrong, because America simply cannot say, Israel, you're on your own. It just wouldn't work. And one of the reasons it wouldn't work is because we have a very powerful Jewish lobby in America.
Naast Joodse organisaties en de politieke lobbygroep APEC scharen Walt en Mearsheimer ook de miljoenen evangelische christenen onder de Israël-lobby. Allen hebben zich tot doel gesteld om de belangen van Israël te verdedigen en kritiek op Israël te doen verstommen.
Er is een nieuwe dag in Amerika tussen christenen en Jews. We don't agree on everything, but we agree on this: that we are going to be together. Inseparable in the defense of Israel and the Jewish people.
The
We have millions of people in the infrastructure. We have over 22,000 spiritual leaders, and some of those spiritual leaders have a million or a million and a half names on their mailing list. We have the major radio television ministries in America supporting what we're doing because every evangelical believes the Bible, and the Bible has a clear mandate to be supportive of the state of Israel.
Volgens John Hagee verplicht de Bijbel alle christenen om Israël te steunen. Ook ziet hij Iran en andere islamitische staten als de antichrist, omdat ze uit zijn op de vernietiging van de staat Israël. Na de laatste Libanonoorlog in de zomer van 2006 haalde zijn congregatie 8 miljoen dollar op om de Israëli's te steunen.
Again, there's a new Hitler, and he's the president of Iran, and he intends to build nuclear weapons, and his brazen declarations against the Jews in America have been carried on the front pages of America's newspapers. Ladies and gentlemen, we must demonstrate courage. We must demonstrate intellectual honesty. We must demonstrate the willingness to stand up and to speak out. We must act now to stop Iran before the maniacal dream of exterminating the Jewish people becomes a nuclear holocaust. And I am hopeful that the American government will have the courage to help Israel in its day of adversity against tyrants.
I don't think there's ever a time that you can say you have enough support. I think that our objective is to always let our elected officials know that, A, we do support Israel, and that if anyone comes against Israel in a malicious way, we would do everything in our power to see that that was their last term in office.
Earl Hilliard was zo'n congreslid. Hij wilde in de jaren 90 de banden met het Afrikaanse Libië aanhalen. Een land waar de Verenigde Staten op dat moment geen diplomatieke banden mee hadden en dat zij onder de Axis of Evil schaarden. Hilliard bezocht het land meerdere malen en had nauw contact met Gaddafi.
What AIPAC did, some members of the United States Congress rather, they put in resolutions condemning Libya. And they just kept them in the resolutions with Syria and with Iran and with Iraq. They kept putting them in that in resolution and kept pushing for all kinds of sanctions, all kinds of action against them. And of course, I voted against the resolution, and others started voting against it. I think what later I found out what really made them angry. Other members of Congress came to me and wanted to know what was happening, and I was telling them, we're trying to negotiate.
So what happened?
I was looking at CNN. Several people had called me and told me what they had seen and heard, and they told me, look at CNN.
In de aanloop naar de volgende verkiezingen bleek dat Hilliard's politieke tegenstander in zijn district in Alabama meer dan $300,000 aan campagnegeld had gekregen uit New York. Een ongekend hoog bedrag.
And they flooded the radio and TV with commercials. Those commercials, and you have to understand the mode that the country was in. We had just gone through 9/11. And most Americans didn't know Hussein from Gaddafi or Gaddafi from Bin Laden. They didn't know the difference. They all saw them as the same. And the commercial, many commercials, put me with them, saying I supported them.
Support and finance International Terror Network.
It had image of the airplanes flying into the World Trade Center. I tell you, I was dropping rapidly in the polls. We had continued polling. I was dropping rapidly in the polling. I say it was, you have to admit it was well planned and they executed it. Afterthought, it said, my goodness, they had it together. I lost the election.
Thank you so much.
But you have to understand, you're talking about a forbidden subject. No one wants to talk about Jews. It's a no-no. It's like you're talking about something that's wrong. You're not even supposed to give your opinion.
So you think it's very difficult for me to even ask questions about the Israel lobby in Washington?
Absolutely. Very difficult to get answers. Very difficult to get interviews. I hope you're successful. I wish you well. It's going to be rough.
There is an enormous, very, very powerful machine out there that notes immediately when someone takes anti-Israel positions and moves out on the attack. I'll give you a very concrete example. I had mentioned the Mearsheimer-Walt study once in a seminar at one of the universities where I teach. And within 48 hours, I had an email from Alan Dershowitz.
Who is he?
Yeah, Alan Dershowitz is a Harvard professor who protects the Jewish lobby in America like an attack dog. I had an email from him, and the email essentially said he didn't think I was doing justice to the American-Israeli relationship, to Israel's existence in the world, etc., by citing the Walt Mearsheimer report because it was so heavily flawed, mistaken, and so forth. And he even attached his own attack on the Walt Mearsheimer report and advised me to use it as counterbalance in my seminar. Well, I wasn't even using the report in my seminar. I simply had mentioned it as evidence of some people's ire, if you will, with the lack of discussion, the lack of debate on these issues in America. And within 48 hours, I had one of the attack dogs for the Jewish lobby coming after me.
But how could he know this?
There are people all over America, on campuses all across America, who are set up to do just what he did, to protect the interest of Jewish Americans and particularly the interest of Israel in America. In that sense, the Jewish lobby is probably more organized and more able to move swiftly against any potential threat than any other lobby.
I was invited this autumn to speak at an organization called 2020, and we agreed on my subject, U.S. foreign policy and the Middle East and the Israel lobby, because this was a big issue in the newspapers at the time. And I heard nothing until about a week before my talk. I was informed by her secretary, the president of this organization's secretary, that we would be meeting at the Polish consulate, which is the usual place apparently where they met. And then the next week, 2 hours before I was supposed to talk, I had a telephone call from the organization's leader, terribly upset, saying the Polish consul general had canceled the talk there at the consulate because of telephone calls he had received from the American Jewish Committee and the Anti-Defamation League. Well, the consul's position, I can understand, is very difficult. Poland in this country, if you say to someone, Poland, the thought they have is anti-Semitism immediately. So Poland has a problem of overcoming this image here. The new Polish government, which is not a very attractive one, has nonetheless been working very hard to try to build good relations with Washington, to be friendly with Israel, to show that it's a good guy, and so on these subjects. And now suddenly someone comes along and says to the Polish consul general in New York, you know, Tony Jart is a very controversial character, he's anti-Israel, his remarks, some people think, are anti-Semitic. Are you sure you want to have him? Bad for your image, bad for your diplomacy. But why would the Poles stand up heroically for my right to speak? They have bigger concerns, so I don't blame them.
In the lobby, what it's doing is it's going after people in a really hard-hitting way for the purposes of shutting us down and also for the purposes of sending a message to other people that if you follow in the footsteps of Jimmy Carter or you follow in the footsteps of Tony Judd or you follow in the footsteps of John Mearsheimer and Steve Walt, you will pay a serious price for your transgressions. Right, so that's a deterrence model. They're trying to deter other people from doing what we did.
Kenneth Roth is directeur van Human Rights Watch, een onafhankelijke NGO die schendingen van mensenrechten onderzoekt. Na hun rapportage over de Libanonoorlog is Roth persoonlijk onder vuur komen te liggen.
I was wondering if you can comment on the fact that in the press in the United States you are called an anti-Semite and demonizing the Jewish state concerning Human Rights Watch reporting in the Lebanon war.
Human Rights Watch's fairly extensive reporting during the war, reporting that I should say focused both on Hezbollah's indiscriminate attacks into Israel and on Israel's indiscriminate bombardment in Lebanon, was met by some reflexive defenders of Israel, not with rational discourse, not with a discussion of the facts, but with name-calling. Including accusations of anti-Semitism, of blood libel, of you know, this or that.
We're used to being attacked by, say, the governments who we're criticizing. But in this case, the Israeli government was actually rather quiet. And indeed, we had what you might call a reasonable dialogue with the Israeli government in the course of the war about what was happening in Lebanon. But it was the supporters of the Israeli government, principally in the United States, although to a limited extent in Israel, who came at us full force. And that was unusual, because we rarely encounter that kind of coordinated attack by ostensibly private individuals, people who had no official position with the Israeli government, but who had assumed for themselves the position of reflexively defending Israel, regardless of its conduct.
It's going to be a big political fight. We'll be working in it.
Thank you so much, and good luck to Israel.
Thank you.
Does it matter that you are Jewish?
I think in the course of the debate over the Lebanon war, it was significant because it was harder for the reflexive defenders of Israel to simply dismiss me as being anti-Semitic. It just didn't have any credibility. My father fled the Nazi Holocaust. My mother's parents fled pogroms in Poland and Belarus. I'm just not a candidate for anti-Semitism. And while there is the old kind of tired line of self-hating Jew, it doesn't describe me either. And nobody even really bothers with that kind of criticism anymore.
Why? Why? Why not just let ineffective people like me do our little talking? Here we have to come back to something else. It wasn't always like this. It began in the 70s. With the rise of identity politics in this country, where it became fashionable and eventually politically and economically normal for people to think of themselves as black Americans, Italian Americans, Irish Americans, no one says, I'm a Jewish American. If someone says, you're a Jewish American, it has a slightly uncomfortable air to it. But they have to have an identity. The sense of the need to have the same kind of cultural identity as Italian Americans or black Americans or Hispanic Americans have has created in the American Jewish community two external identification tags. One is Israel and the other is Auschwitz, so to speak, one in space and one in time. To be a Jew is to be moved by the memory of the Holocaust and to identify with Israel. Even if you have no personal connection with the Holocaust and you've never been to Israel, which is true for most of them. The result is that they are extraordinarily sensitive politically and personally. It's not an invented political thing. People feel this to any suggestion that there is criticism of Israel or forgetting of the Holocaust because it touches the core identity of American Jews.
The State of Israel was the dream of your ancestors, made a reality by your grandparents and your parents.
Every year, AIPAC has a conference where they bring in their supporters from around the country. They meet in Washington, a very powerful group that attempts to affect legislation and other aspects of U.S. policy on the Mideast. And it's sort of a gala affair. There's a Hollywood element where they produce these videos that show, they get people all mobilized and roused, sort of a pep rally atmosphere. And they get an extraordinary number of high officials to come.
America and Israel share an unbreakable bond.
AIPAC is one of the reasons why.
All of us share a fundamental belief that the freedom and security of Israel are vital interests of the United States of America.
We need you now more than ever.
It's become like it's a ritual where they have to, the officials have to go to sort of show that they are on AIPAC's side. You know, half the Congress shows up, top administration officials, and they have a keynote speaker every year who is invariably at the very top.
From Florida, Bill Nelson.
From Nebraska, Ben Nelson.
From Illinois, Barack Obama.
From Arkansas, Mark Ryan.
Can we have a picture first, please?
Wait, wait. I think I might have blinked on that one.
From South Carolina, Joe Wilson.
From California, Lynn Woolsey.
From Oregon, David Wu.
From Maryland, Albert Wynn.
From Kentucky, John Yarmuth. And I also want to mention former member of Congress, Rob.
AIPAC does an excellent job of constantly testing the loyalty of people in Congress to their cause. And so there's a constant stream of resolutions that get proposed on the Mideast, expressing support for Israel about something it's done, or sympathy with victims of a suicide bombing, or condemning Iran or other people in the region who are being hostile to Israel. And these become tests of sort of loyalty of people in Congress on this issue. And those who vote in the way that AIPAC wants will in many ways be rewarded ultimately with campaign contributions from people sympathetic to AIPAC. AIPAC itself does not give money, but they sort of, this whole series of votes and their very careful cataloging of how people vote very much affects where people make decisions about who to give the money to.
Money does not flow into a particular congressman's coffers or a senator's coffers unless he supports positions taken by the lobby. That's their first, I think, major influence is money. And this administration is awash in money, more so probably than any administration in American history.
For 2 months, we've been trying to get in contact with Congress people who voted nay to certain of the bills that were supported by AIPAC, but nobody wanted to speak to us. Is that normal?
Yeah, this is an issue where a congressperson will see no gain to be made by speaking on it. Just even voting against AIPAC's recommended positions is perilous for them, because it can lead to a reduction in campaign funds. It can create all kinds of problems in their home district.
But they voted nay. I mean,
they did. But they don't want to go even more public about it. A film clip in particular, can you imagine a campaign opponent using that? It could become the basis of a negative campaign ad. And look, this person is against Israel's interest. Whenever I have spoken to people on Capitol Hill about this, it's almost always on a not-for-attribution basis.
I was told off the record once by a very prominent Democratic senator. We were at a meeting in Paris, and it was late in the evening, we were sitting in a hotel, he was talking about the Middle East, and he was saying things about Israel which were very similar to the criticisms that I would make. And so I said to him, but you never say these things in the Senate. Why not? Is it because you're worried about the Jewish vote? He said, forget it, it's nothing to do with the Jewish vote. I come from a state, I can't tell you where, because otherwise, where there are very few Jews, and they're all going to vote for me anyway, so it doesn't matter. So it's not the Jewish vote, that's not the issue. It's not money, I don't get money from the Israel lobby, that's not the issue. But he said, suppose that I walk onto the Senate floor and say in a moving speech why we need to take our distance from Israel and understand better what has happened to the Palestinians. Maybe I would win 5-10 senators over to a general motion criticizing Israel, maximum. He said, but that's all I could get. And he said, in return, I would be finished in the Senate because no one would ever vote again for my needs. If I wanted to move something for my state, or an education bill, or a financial bill, or a tax bill, or anything to do with domestic policy, nothing to do with Israel, I would be punished.
I bet that it's impossible for either Steve or I to ever get a high-level policy-making position in the American government. For example, Steve was invited to go to a dinner with an aspiring presidential candidate at Harvard. And the person who had invited Steve to this dinner came to see Steve about a week after the piece came out. And she said that she had to disinvite him from the dinner because the presidential candidate's staff had called and said that it would not be acceptable for the presidential candidate to be at a dinner with him.
America and Israel have a special friendship.
You have devoted yourselves to strengthening the bonds between the United States and Israel.
The United States will stand with Israel now and forever.
If a politician would rise with this point of view, that the United States should stop supporting Israel, what would be the effect, do you think?
He'd lose the next election, almost certainly. Now, there may be a district here or there out of the... We have 435 members of the House and 100 senators, 535. We have 52 governors. It's certainly possible that some congressional district somewhere would reelect a candidate who had said we should abandon Israel, reject the relationship with Israel. But it's pretty unlikely, and I would be surprised if there are more than two or three or four congressional districts in which it's even conceivable.
I appreciate it. But we can't vote you, and
okay.
I'm sorry.
But I appreciate, but I appreciate the friendship.
If you will come in Italy, I want to introduce you in a member of a parliament, Italian parliament.
I would enjoy that very
okay?
much.
Thank
sure. you so much.
Thank you for everything.
Friends owe it to friends to be as candid as possible. So let me say that a precipitous American withdrawal from Iraq would be a disaster for the United States and the entire Middle East. A sudden withdrawal of our coalition would dissipate much of the effort that's gone into fighting the global war on terror and result in chaos and mounting danger. And for the sake of our own security, we will not stand by and let it happen.
I would argue that had you not had all of these neoconservatives prominently placed inside the Bush administration, that Colin Powell would have never ended up giving that disgraceful presentation in early February 2003 that played such a critical role in turning American public opinion.
This is an important day for us all as we review the situation with respect to Iraq and its disarmament obligations under UN Security Council Resolution 1441.
I realized as I watched it there at the UN Security Council for the first time, because every time I watched it before, I was, you know, running around trying to get things changed, do this, do that, talking about the graphics and everything else. But there in the UN Security Council, I sat down quietly and watched Secretary Powell make his presentation.
My colleagues, Every statement I make today is backed up by sources, solid sources. These are not assertions. What we're giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence. As I show you these images, I will try to capture and explain what they mean, what they indicate to our imagery specialists. Let's look at one. The four that are in red squares represent active chemical munitions bunkers.
I wouldn't go to war based on that. That's what I told myself. I would not go to war based on that. There was, most of it could be interpreted different from the way we were presenting it.
As these drawings, based on their description, show, we know what the fermenters look like. We know what the tanks, pumps, compressors, and other parts look like. And we know a great deal about the platforms on which they are mounted.
I walked outside the United Nations building on February the 5th after the presentation had been made into the kind of bracing cold New York air, and I thought it was a total failure. I thought I had failed because I was the person who put it together, responsible for putting it together. Then later, a couple of days later, 3 days later or so, when I'd had some sleep and I could think about it, I wondered why the reaction seemed to be fairly positive. We hadn't persuaded that many people who were adamantly opposed, but we had made some impact, particularly on the American people. And I think we made a little impact on the international community, too, probably in the UK in particular. And so I realized the reason for that. And the reason was Colin Powell gave the presentation. Colin Powell, who had poll ratings roughly equivalent with Mother Teresa, had made the presentation, and the American people believe Colin Powell. If Colin Powell said it was so, then it was so. That made me feel even worse. So yes, I have trouble sometimes sleeping at night thinking about my participation in it.
1995, the quantities were vast. Less than a teaspoon of dry anthrax, a little bit about this amount. This is just about the amount of a teaspoon. Less than a teaspoon of dry anthrax.
So the question you have to ask yourself is, if the evidence was so flimsy, why did Powell get up and make an unequivocal, such an unequivocal case that Iraq had WMD and was an imminent threat? And the reason is that there was tremendous pressure inside and outside the administration to make that argument. And the question is, who was creating that pressure? And the answer is, it was the neoconservatives, almost single-handedly.
Dick Cheney and his minions have brought, and Richard Perle is one of his minions, and Doug Feith is one of his minions, have brought the art of lying to a new scale, a new level. Was oil the number one influence on President Bush and Vice President Cheney? Or was WMD? Or was spreading democracy? And don't believe it for a moment. They didn't even think about spreading democracy when they started this war. They transmogrified the mission into starting or democracy simply to appease the American people and to give them some reason to support the war. You have to decide, where were these factors? And inevitably, the Jewish lobby in America, AIPAC in particular, the focus lobby, has got to be there. You're being naive if you don't put that factor up there as an influence on national security decision-making, particularly with the Bush administration. The AIPAC lobby is very influential through Vice President Cheney, very influential, and through people like Elliot Abrams, Paul Wolfowitz, and a host of others within the government.
And of course, you don't want to lose sight of the fact that the Israeli government was also feeding the United States government intelligence, which said that Iraq had a serious WMD capability and was an imminent threat. There's an Israeli general named Shlomo Brom who has written a piece on this, which says, in effect, that Israel was a full partner in this scheme to convince the public in the United States and around the globe that Iraq was an imminent threat. Iraq was not an imminent threat. The fact is that even if Saddam had nuclear weapons, there was nothing he could do with them, right? But you could not make those arguments at the time in the United States. It's very, very hard to get them out into the public domain and for them to get any traction.
Do you agree with Mearsheimer and Wolt that the influence of the pro-Israel lobby was important for going to war with Iraq?
I do, but I would not have presented it the way they did, because I think that they underestimate ideas, and they underestimate, if you like, emotions. They're very cold and realistic in their view of politics. And for them, since the going to war with Iraq is absolutely crazy, and it was pretty obviously crazy for many of us before, there must have been some pressure to do something so irrational. And of course there was, but they underestimate other factors. The illusion, for example, that we could have control of Iraq's oil and of the strategic region. The belief, which is a deep American belief, which was not invented by the Jewish lobby, that America knows how democracy should work and is an example to the world and has a moral duty and certainly a right to bring this example to the world. And it's all mixed together. So ideals, belief about American exceptionalism, American duties, American provincialism, not knowing about what's going on outside, and Israeli pressure, yes.
The suggestion that that the Israeli lobby, as he describes it, is in effect operated by the Israelis and reflects Israeli preferences is simply wrong and can be shown to be wrong.
So you don't feel part of an Israeli lobby?
No, I'm not part of an Israeli lobby. I have my own views. I'm sympathetic to Israel, as most Americans are sympathetic to Israel. I'm not incapable of being critical of an Israeli policy that I don't like. But the main point is that it is not the Israeli government that shapes the thinking of Americans who are pro-Israeli.
Richard Pearl would probably say in response to your question, if you got the truth out of them, Israel's interests and America's interests are the same. And so if I'm an advocate for Israel's interest, I'm an advocate for America's interest. And I would say back to them, again, as a strategist, bullshit. No two countries in history, and no two countries in the future in history, I will predict, will ever have coincidental national interest all the time. No way.
Kind of develop this great sense of victimhood, but I do feel, and it's, you know, I come here and I feel that we in Israel have paid the price.
Daniel Levy diende in het Israëlische leger en was voor Israël onderhandelaar bij de vredesbesprekingen in Genève, Oslo II en Taba. Hij werkt nu in Washington en heeft zich ten doel gesteld een ander Joods geluid te laten horen.
American Jews, surprise, surprise, are liberal Democrats when it comes to most issues, including the Middle East. So when you poll American Jews, they're for the peace process and they're for American engagement and they're for a two-state solution. And we did the Geneva Initiative and they were in favor of that as well. But the institutional organized leadership of the community has kind of taken things in a very different direction. And I do feel that for their own reasons, reasons that I understand, reasons that are not unique to the Jewish diaspora in America, reasons that are prevalent in many diaspora politics around the world. It's to do with my identity in a diaspora, it's to do partially with guilt, it's to do with my own political role in my new host community, etc., etc. They've driven so-called pro-Israel politics in Washington in a direction which is directly antithetical to what is good for Israel. In that respect, yes, I do feel we paid a price. Of course, that has been increased manyfold under the current administration.
America has become part of the Israeli victim narrative. It began, I think, in the 70s, when one of the ways in which the African-American community could begin to get amends for slavery and the consequences of slavery was by emphasizing that it was a victim of history. That even if you didn't do it, history did it. Your grandparents did it. It's not a personal responsibility, but as a cultural debt. And the Holocaust, of course, is the ultimate victim narrative. And David Ben-Gurion, the first Israeli prime minister, knew this very well, because he turned it to advantage, giving Israel as a whole country a victim narrative. If you can't criticize someone because he himself is a victim, what do you do with a whole country, which is a country born of victimhood, so to speak? I have been in conversations many times with people who are very reasonable and would say, yes, you're right, Israel does do bad things. The occupied territories, stealing the water, stealing the land, bombing the houses, etc. But remember what happened to the Jews. There is a background, there is a history, there is a reason, there is an excuse for this. And of course, you know, you can say the same thing for the Palestinians. Remember what happened to the Palestinians after the Nakba in 1948 and so on, 1967. No wonder they have suicide bombers. You can always do this. There's always a relationship between collective past suffering and present individual actions. To turn that into public policy, though, is catastrophic, and that is what we see today.
The what if? The what if this particular view of the Israeli interest and of the shared Israeli-American interest, which of course someone like myself would see as absolutely antithetical to my understanding of Israel's interests, if that particular view is continued to be bulldozed onto the American public and political leadership, what if there's a backlash? And the kind of backlash that I think can be envisaged is the kind of backlash whereby eventually enough of the American public, and eventually by extension their elected public officials, turn round and say, we need to disengage from our overstretch in the Middle East.
Could be that as a consequence of what happens in Iraq and what happens in Iran, that people become very angry with our relationship with Israel, and there's just an upsurge of public opinion. It could be that you have two or three senators who come out and make a very forceful case for changing our policy.
It just isn't going to happen. It is not going to happen. And you could eliminate, by some waving a magic wand, you could eliminate the Israeli lobby that Walt and Mearsheimer talk about, and everything I've said would continue to be true.
I will make a prediction. If this president orders us to go to war in Iran in the next 2 years, and he orders any considerable ground component to participate in that, Marines or Army, then I think you're going to see another major exodus from the armed forces, general officers, because I think they understand just how colossally wrong such a decision would be and how much that would be the precursor for, call it what you will, World War III, World War IV.
Remember the Roman Empire. For a long, long time, the state of Judea behaved in ways which annoyed the Romans but didn't do them any harm. At the point at which they were becoming a nuisance, the Romans turned against them, destroyed their temple, wiped them out, and told them, an empire has bigger concerns than you. This is what Israel faces in the next 25 years. The risk that the American empire will say, wait a minute, you don't matter to us so much. Either because we need oil more than we need you, or because oil is no longer important. Doesn't matter, both has the same effect. You are more trouble than you are worth. And the issue of the Holocaust and anti-Semitism is declining with demographic move to the next generation. This is a catastrophe for Israel, because Israel has no other friends in the world.
Thank you.